And retirement will be called to order. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. It is February 28th, Tuesday night, and we have a very interesting agenda. But before we do that, we do have a quorum, and I would like to have a motion for the approval. Thank you, Representative Vogel. There has been a motion to approve the February 21st meeting minutes. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Folks and members, this is going to be a listening session, and we are going to go through the discuss the benefits and features of the MSRS General, the Parageneral, and the TRA proposals. The staff is going to go through a presentation on possible benefit changes and the cost savings. This is all under consideration. We're going to listen to what is being proposed, the numbers, and we're going to have that under consideration. The meetings ongoing, March 7th and the 14th, 21st, 28th, those will where we'll start building our bill. We'll have some presentations on the volunteer fire bills and the specific bills for cities. The Fairview MSRS proposal and report will be next week, the privatization portion. So we will start building our bill at that point. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, will we at some point have another conversation around House File 565 at all?
Would you like that?
If we could, I think that might be helpful.
That'd be fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Absolutely. We could do that next week. Or if we have time tonight, we could do it too.
Madam Chair.
Anderson.
Madam Chair, maybe next week to give people some time.
Okay.
So we can talk offline.
Okay, great. Thank you. With that, we are going to have, members, you have this consideration of possible pension plan benefit changes in your packet. And you also have this a longer sheet talking about the statewide general employee pension plans, benefit analysis, and possible cost-saving changes, February 6th. So with that, I will turn it over to Susan Lincheski, please. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. At a recent Pension Commission meeting, the Commission considered proposals by MSRS, that is the Minnesota State Retirement System, the Teachers Retirement Association, TRA, and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. The proposals are intended to address each plan's underfunding and put them on a path toward full funding. The proposals include contribution increases and, for MSRS and TRA, COLA reductions. We'll talk a little more on the specifics of those in a minute. The chair and vice chair of the commission, Senator Rosen and Representative O'Driscoll, wanted to take a step back from what was being presented in the proposals and do a more comprehensive review of the plans with a focus on benefits and possible changes to the benefits in the plans. I'll go through the presentation, which is the 29 pages of, it's labeled Consideration of Possible Benefit, Pension Plan Benefit Changes. To lay the groundwork, and this is very basic, but I just want to kind of give you that to get us all in the same place. There are really two ways to fix a pension plan funding shortfall. One is to increase the dollars going in, and those would be in the form of contributions or additional earnings on investments. The second is to reduce the dollars going out. What we'll be talking about tonight primarily is the latter. So we're looking at possible ways that you could reduce the dollars going out of the plans. So quickly to look at what is the funding shortfall. This is on slide 3. The funding status using the current 8% investment return assumption, and currently for TRA, that investment return assumption is 8.5. This is where the plans are in terms of the funded ratio, which is the market value of assets divided by actuarial liabilities. MSRS is at about 78%. PERA is at 72%. TRA is at 72%. About 73%, and teachers at about 60%. If we go ahead and drop the investment return assumption to 7.5%, the funding status gets a little less rosy, or certainly reduces the funding status. So MSRS General goes to 76.8%, para goes to 68.8%, TRA to 65%, and teachers to about 58%. The plans on slide four, I have put out the proposals from the plans, and these are the requests for more contributions. MSRS General is requesting a 1.5% increase in FY18 and then another 1% in FY20 to a total of 2.5% increase on the employer contribution amount. The employee increase that's being requested would be a 0.5% increase in FY18. Para General is not requesting any increases in contributions this year. TRA, they are going from 7.5% to 9.5% with a 0.5% increase every year, and that is just with regard to the employer contribution. The employee rate will stay at 7.5%. St. Paul teachers will similarly end up at 9.5%, but that will be a 3% increase over the next 4 years, and those are laid out here in the lower right chart on slide four. The employee contribution will remain at 7.5%. In addition, St. Paul is requesting an annual direct state aid appropriation of $5 million.
And members, if there are questions, just flag me during this presentation. Okay? Thank you.
So I'll just mention just a little bit of context back on slide four. The market value of assets for each of the plans, MSRS is at $11.2 billion, PARA at $18 billion, TRA at $19.4 billion, and St. Paul Teachers at $960 million. So you can kind of get a sense, I guess, and this really relates more to the funding shortfall slide, but you can get a sense then of what we're talking about in terms of dollars and what that shortfall represents. Okay, moving then to slide five. I've tried to lay out here the dollar amounts.
Who do we have here? Representative Murphy.
Could you repeat those?
Yeah.
Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, Representative Murphy. This is market value of assets as of June 30th, 2016. MSRS, $11.2 billion, PARA, $18 billion, TRA, $19.4 billion, and St. Paul Teachers, $960 million.
Representative Vogel, you good? Okay, thank you. Ms. Lencheski.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Sinjum.
Since we sort of broke for questions, if we went back to slide four, where we see proposed increases, and generally speaking, that page sort of leans towards employer increases. But if we were to take each one of those funds and look at it, you know, over a longer period of time, even 10 years, would we see a more balanced approach? I mean, is it always employer increases, or is it there are some years when it's different, where we go more to the employee and less to the employer?
Ms. Lencheski.
I mean, if we were just looking at over, and I'm not sure if that's a line graph I'm talking about or what, but is it kind of always this way, or is it?
Yes.
Is it more balanced if we looked at it over time?
That's a good question.
Senator Dames. Senator Sinjum. Senator Rosen. The rates are in the statute, so we could look back at what they have been historically, but they don't really fluctuate from year to year. They don't at all fluctuate. So these changes now will be made to the employer contribution, employee contribution rates, and they will stay in statute, and that'll be the amount that's contributed every year. So it's a percentage of payroll. And we could certainly get you sort of historical information as to where it has been, but they don't really fluctuate from year to year, except for payroll. As payroll changes, then the contribution dollars would change.
Well, thank you very much.
Is Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Senja, maybe that was the answer to your question, but I heard you ask it. I took away that in the past when there have been employer-employee increases on contributions, have they been more equal in that? And the answer is yes. We're starting to see a little bit more of a disconnect between what employees are being asked under these plan proposals versus what the employing entities are being asked to pay. Okay.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I recognize that probably it would be nice to have all of these at 100%. Is there kind of a standard that we are shooting for overall, knowing that it's probably not going to be 100%, but where would we like to or need to be maybe for the longer term?
Ms. Lucheski.
Senator Rosen, Representative Vogel, I think that's ultimately up to the commission where you'd like to see these plans. I think, too, it may be a question for the commissioner of MMB. The funding ratio, I think, feeds into the credit rating, how the agencies view the state and then what they think about the state's stability for purposes of credit for lending. So I think that's where we are in that. But I would say that most plans across the country are, seldom touching 90%. I mean, 90% is probably a reasonable place to be, but I think most of them are kind of where our plans are. They're kind of in the 70 to 80% range. Okay, thank you. So over on slide 5, so this lays out what these are in dollars. So these are the contribution increases. So the rate of the contribution then is applied to payroll. And these numbers are the increases in dollars over the prior year. So, for instance, in the case of MSRS General, the increase over the prior year will be 43.3% for FY18. In FY19, that same amount will be contributed to the plan. There isn't actually an increase, but that same amount as compared to the base that we're starting at now. So the total for the biennium would be 43.3 times 2, or 86.6. So in the case of TRA, they're doing the 0.5% contribution increase every year. So in the second year, FY19, the 24.3 is an increase over the prior 24.3. So for the biennium, you would take 24.3 times 3 to get to the total for the biennium. To get to the amount for all 4 years, of course, then just it's just math, building on this as being the base year.
So if you turn to slide 6.
Ms. Bartz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there is an array of benefits that could be modified to reduce the cost of benefits. Generally, the benefits you choose to modify really depends on the outcome you would like to achieve. Benefit modifications can significantly impact a pension plan's funding situation. Again, the impact really depends on the benefit and the extent of the modification. The greater the immediate savings, the more significant the impact on long-term funding improvement. And the main reason for this effect is that the more money you save right away and therefore have, the more money you can therefore invest. Not all benefit reductions result in savings. This is mainly due to member behavior in response to the change. So, for example, reducing a benefit could cause a greater number of members than expected to take that benefit before the change goes into effect, which could have an adverse effect on the financial impact of the plan and even the impact of the benefit change. So, slide 7. So talking about COLA reductions, which is reducing the amount of cash that's leaving the plan. So we talked about contributions, money going in, COLA, money going out. Currently, under MSRS and TRA, each January 1, retirees' pensions are automatically increased by 2%. Para and St. Paul offer a 1% COLA. So the percentage increase compounds annually, and that percentage is applied to an ever-increasing base amount. So every single year, it's compounded, and the base gets bigger and bigger. So this benefit is referred to in statutes as the post-retirement adjustment, or more commonly, as we refer to it, as the COLA. So on slide 8, just as a refresher, we've kind of discussed all of the plans, funding proposals, but for MSRS General, they're proposing to reduce their COLA from 2% to 1.5% and eliminating the COLA trigger, which, again, is that mechanism that automatically increases the COLA from 2% to 2.5% if the plan reaches a 90% funding ratio 2 years in a row. And you can also see sort of just the impact of reducing the COLA from 2% to 1.5% in dollars for each year and then percent of pay. And the COLA trigger, as of right now, actually doesn't really have any value because it's predicted to happen so far out that it doesn't have any sort of savings tied to it anymore. Parageneral is not proposing any changes to their COLA. Their COLA is already at 1%, and I would like to note that the Para Board did not approve eliminating the trigger, so that COLA trigger is remaining for Parageneral as of right now. For TRA, they are proposing to reduce the COLA from 2% to 1% for 5 years and then increasing that back up to 1.5% thereafter and eliminating the COLA trigger. And St. Paul Teachers right now is just proposing to eliminate the trigger, and again, because their COLA is already at 1%. All right. So for slide 9, this is actually an excerpt from what's been in the members' packets on the Minnesota Pension Basics. And so this chart really just lays out general member data for the general and the teacher plans to give you a better idea of how the plans compare to each other. The information is based on coordinated members only, so these are plan participants who do receive Social Security. And it's MSRS General, Parageneral, TRA, St. Paul Teachers. And I just want to explain some of these categories in a little bit more detail. So the first category you're going to see is the accrual rate, which is the multiplier or percentage used to calculate a member's final benefit. So that percentage is multiplied by the member's high five average salary and years of service. So when any of these factors, high five, years of service, or the accrual rate are higher, the benefit is higher. So a higher accrual rate means that you will have a larger benefit. MSRS and PARA provide a 1.7% accrual rate, and TRA and St. Paul provide a 1.9% accrual rate. And you'll see the investment return assumption, which we've talked about. I'm not going to go into any more detail on that other than to note what the current assumptions are. The next is the vesting period, which is the number of years a member must work before they are eligible to receive a benefit. If an employee leaves before they satisfy that requirement, they are given a refund of their contributions plus interest at 4%, but the employer contribution stays with the plan. So the vesting period for MSRS and PARA is 5 years, and for TRA and St. Paul, it's 3 years. And then you can just kind of look at closely more at the demographics of active membership, retirees, the average salary, average annual pension, and then just one group I would really like to point out, because we will be discussing this group a little bit more in detail later in the presentation, is the deferred vested members group. So that's right underneath the retiree membership number. Excuse me. And these are individuals who have satisfied the applicable vesting requirement and are therefore eligible to receive benefits, but they terminate their public employment before they retire, so before they're eligible to take their retirement. And when they terminate, they have two options. They can either take a refund of the employee contributions plus interest, or they can leave the contributions with the plan, where the benefit is then automatically increased by a certain percentage each year, which is what we call augmentation. The augmentation rate for each plan is on the last line of this chart. And so all plans except for Parageneral provide a 2% annual increase for these deferred members' benefits. Parageneral provides 1% for members who terminated before January 1, 2012, and 0% for members who terminated after that date. So that's the big difference between those with deferred members. And then finally, the chart just goes into the employer contribution rate and employee contribution rates. And I just kind of want to note for TRA and St. Paul why there are two percentages right there. The employers pay a regular employer contribution rate and then a supplemental contribution rate. So TRA receives 0.2% from the Minneapolis School District, which is a result of the Minneapolis merger. And then St. Paul receives that 3.85% from the employer.
Okay, Ms. Sencheski.
Okay, thank you. So now
excuse me. Oh, is there any questions?
I do.
Yeah,
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Albright.
Ms. Barth, could we go back to slide number 9?
Yes.
And I know this may be,
Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this may be something that the staff can work on, but as I look at the active membership and the retired membership, I show, or I see, an alarming trend that I'd like maybe a little more workup on terms of what's the number of people that are moving on a yearly basis from active membership to retiree membership? And then consequently, how many are becoming active members to the point of addressing what's the population shift away from active to retiree as we look at and contemplate funding mechanisms that obviously have to take care of both populations, but we may be fighting an uphill battle if we look at the memberships of both of those segments. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, Ms. Lencheski.
So we're going to move into the benefits, the benefit change section, I guess. So I just, here again, we're going through some basic stuff here, but it's good to think of the pension plan in the context of what individuals are generally receiving or have already taken care of or in the process of taking care of. The traditional way to look at retirement is, the analogy is a three-legged stool. There are individual savings, and this includes retirement savings such as in another employer plan like a 401k, our state's deferred compensation plan, or in the case of the teachers, 403b plan. In addition, Social Security benefits will be payable to all these people. We're talking about the coordinated people, the coordinated members, and they will all have Social Security. And then finally, the employer-sponsored retirement plan, which is these pension plans. So the point being that this isn't the only source of retirement income. And then in addition, mainly because of the cost of health care, many people in retirement are continuing to work on a part-time basis or full-time in order to make sure they have health care coverage, at least going a little further into retirement. On page...
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we know how many people in these plans actually have 403B plans or other individual saving plans beyond their pension?
Ms. Lencheski.
Senator Rosen, Representative Thiessen, I don't have that information. We do have quite a good population of the state's employees in the deferred comp plan, but I could certainly follow up with you and get some specifics on what the participation is in these other plans.
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, and how much they're deferring to would be helpful, not just the number, you know, because if it's a tiny amount that. And then speaking of the health care side, is there a good, Madam Chair, is there a good reference for what retiree, like what inflation is to a retiree? You know, because we have CPI, but I would assume if you're retired and you don't have another job, as an example, health care costs are going to make the actual inflation that you're facing in life much higher than CPI. So is there another measure of that about how much we actually have to, I mean, because the whole point of the COLA, right, is to cover the cost of living increases. And I imagine it's probably higher than 1 or 2% right now if you count in health care costs.
Lencheski.
Senator Rosen, Representative Thiessen, there are studies that I could send to you that show how cost of living, what it is in retirement. And it tends to spike. There's several years where it is high, and then it kind of goes down as you get a little older. There also is a measurement called CPI, I think, elderly. It's not been kind of rolled out generally, but it's been developed, I think, by the same governmental agency that does the CPI UNW, and I could certainly get information to you on that. I do have a little info on what the last 2 years of CPIW has been. And I was going to mention that later, but I can certainly let you know here that for 2016, CPIW was 1%, and for 2015, it was 0.9%. negative 0.4%.
And what does that include, Madam Chair, if I
Representative
could ask? What does CPIW include?
Ms. Lencheski.
I'm sorry. I would have to get you the details on that. It was a pretty broad, it was looking at a lot of costs, but I guess I don't know the specifics on that. And I don't know, it does include medical care or health care, but I can certainly get a lot of detail on that if you'd like.
Thank you.
Ms. Lencheski.
All right, so moving on to page 11, or screen 11. So in, I think, considering our benefit package in these plans, how does the commission assess the current array of benefits? I think one place you can look to is other states' pension plans. It'll certainly tell you if our plans are offering something that is kind of an anomaly or whether what we've got is fairly common among the states, and that might give a starting point to kind of figuring out whether these are benefits we should continue or whether they're benefits that maybe aren't, as effective as doing the cost-benefit analysis on those benefits. For example, we'll talk later, but augmentation is one of those benefits that no other state, barring South Dakota, provides. So that does leave our plans in the position of being one of two other states that provide that benefit. Also, several states don't pay interest on refunds after several years out. So, for instance, if you terminate on year one, you can take a refund and get interest on that refund at some percentage that's just specified in their statutes, but 2 years out, you lose the right to collect interest on a refund. So certainly there are other comparable benefits in other states that could serve as a source for comparing our benefits. Another source, I think, is in the private sector. Obviously, there have been a lot of contraction in the defined benefit plan world out there, but the private sector is years ahead of the public sector in dealing with underfunded plans. And so there are examples there that may be helpful. For instance, eliminating COLAs is extremely common in the private sector, as well as even freezing accruals and just having a plan that provides a set benefit and doesn't continue to increase. Another option is a conversion to a cash balance plan, which is a hybrid type plan and presents the defined benefit in the form of a contribution account, much like a defined contribution plan. So those are comparisons that could be looked to determine whether our benefit package is what we want or whether there are things we can do to change that. Then finally, the third point here is how concerned should the commission be about what the actuaries state is the required contribution to the plan versus what our statutes say the contribution is. And the issue there is that the actuaries are giving the plans every year what the actuaries believe is required to go into the plan to pay off the 1 year's worth of accruals. And so in the valuation reports, you can find that information. The statutes are set, so they require a certain level of contributions. But year after year, those contributions are not what the actuary says should be going in every year. So, for instance, with MSRS, the statutes require contributions equal to 11%, which is 5.5% from the employee, 5.5% from the employer. The actuary stated that 14.5% was needed to cover the amount or the cost of the benefits accrued for 1 year. That shortfall then just keeps adding to the underfunding. For PARA, 14.62 is the amount that's provided for by statute. The actuary stated in the recent report that 16.5% was the required contribution. And these are all percentages of payroll. Similarly, for TRA, the statutory amount was 15.94%. The actuary stated that the required amount was 17.44%. So moving to slide 12, we've kind of gone...
Any questions, Representative Murphy? You had that look.
if we're doing what we thought we were supposed to be doing, but the actuary says we should be at 13 instead of 11, where we thought we were doing what was right. Is that the actuary saying that to make themselves look good, or is that, I don't get why. How did we get to the point that we need the difference between 11 and 13? And we didn't have that before we got there.
Ms. Lanchesca.
We thought we were doing everything right. Right. We were making decisions based on what we were supposed to be doing and what the statute said and what the actuary said. And we got to 11.
Right.
But at what point then does the actuary say we're supposed to be at 13 when we thought we were supposed to be at 11. What's the point? Or
yeah.
Why am I suspicious?
Well,
now it comes out.
Senator Rosen, Representative yes. Murphy, the plans use nationally known actuaries that abide by the Society of Actuaries, standards, and certainly they are not, I don't think, really incentivized to kind of show these numbers in any particular way. This contribution deficiency has been an issue for many years. So we're paying out more benefits than we're bringing in, or really there's the accrual every year of benefits exceeds the amount that's coming in. So in other states, they let that level float. So they don't put it in the statute and say, you're going to pay in 11% every year. They say, we're going to put in what the actuary tells us to put in. Now, the states don't always put in what they're told to put in, but at least it's not in the statutes and it's not set so that they can be, kind of flexible about how they fund their plans. So that's...
Representative Murphy?
So the situation... And there was just several years ago we changed to this new accounting and the GASB or whatever it was and all that stuff. Is that weighing in now, too?
Ms. Lanchesca. Senator Rosen, Representative Murphy. GASB is not actually at all connected to what is going on here. So we have the actuarial valuation, which is separate from the GASB report that relates more to the accounting side of things. So this, the actuarial valuations are available on the website, and it's real easy to find these contribution deficiencies every single year in the reports. And it's just, the problem with, benefits accruing and not sufficient contributions.
And whatever did we do before we had the website?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just curious to the 14.5%, for example, that you talk about that deficiency or the actuarial evaluation. Is that to get the pension funds to 100%?
Ms. Lanchesca.
It just represents the cost of the accrual for one year.
Right?
Yeah, so it just looks, it's a snapshot, just the 1 year, how much benefit has accrued, what's the value of that? And then what's the required contribution to take care of that? So it doesn't really get to the issue of what is it going to look like in 30 years' time? Are we going to be 100%? Now, if you funded it at that level, what the actuary told you, you would certainly get to 100% closer. I mean, you'd get there, but for the fact that we've been doing this for so many years, the idea is you get there in 30 years in your amortization period.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And so how many years has there been a deficiency?
Ms. Lanchesca.
Senator Rosen, Representative Peterson, I can get you that. I don't know how many years, and there are representatives of the plans here that may be able to speak to that, but I don't know, but we can get that to you.
And, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Thiessen.
But that deficiency assumes the rate of return. So if the rate of return is higher, then we would actually make up the money.
Representative Albright.
So to your question,
Representative Thiessen. I think what you're really asking is sufficiency is something to be striven for, but very unlikely that you ever get there because you have demographic details that work against you. So you have longevity standards that are extending. You've got people on the coming inside that are in fewer numbers that are contributing not sufficiently to their own, and so the employer is having to, you know, think of ways to come up with differences. But the actuarial assumption proposes a contribution rate that over time will strive towards that sufficiency. And every year it's a snapshot detailing demographics of the group that's participating in that plan.
All I'm asking is, or just want to clarify, is this, I mean, the deficiency is just the difference between what we're requiring percentage-wise to pay in and what would be required to actually cover the cost of the benefits being paid out. And that's, I mean, putting it very simply, but the benefits, what's needed to be paid in is assuming that we're going to also make an 8% return on that amount. And if we make more than that, then the deficiency would go away. Right? I mean, in that particular year. That's all I wanted to clarify.
Ms. Lencheski.
Yeah, Senator Rosen, Representative Thiessen, I think that's true. If we make better than 8%, then we'll reduce the deficiency for that year. We'll be closer to, you know, what we should be.
So, the point being made, I think we've probably been in a deficiency, to Representative Peterson's point, for many years, for a long time, but it doesn't mean that we're going backwards every year because we've actually made more than 8% in many of those years.
Okay.
So, Jessica.
I don't, Senator Rosen and Representative Thiessen, I think the problem that you get is that there's the actuarial liability and then there's this annual snapshot. And so it's hard to parse through your question, I guess, or your statement to try to make clear which we're talking about. But I think it's true that if we do better than 8%, certainly we're going to get to 100% a whole lot quicker. That's true.
Okay, Ms. Lencheski.
So, I'm sorry.
Oh,
Representative Anderson.
I'm sorry. Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lencheski, this is just kind of going back a couple of slides on the 2% compounded annually. Do we have any idea or can we get data that would show us if we were to remove the compounding, if you will, from this, how quickly would we be able to get into sufficiency?
Ms. Lencheski, we do have some numbers on that.
Good.
Yeah. Augmentation? The compounded augmentation.
Are you getting to it later? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yep. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So we're...
All right. Slide 13.
13.
Senator Rosen.
Okay. Ms. Lencheski.
And I 12, I think we've
12.
Kind of gone
yes.
through. Those questions are kind of straightforward, and we've kind of talked about that. So moving on to some of the other questions I think that are important to ask as you're assessing benefits. One of the questions, I guess, is how should benefits reflect actual experience, such as people living longer and retiring later? So that ties to a couple of the benefit changes that we are looking at here. One is to move the retirement age to 67 and to similarly move back the early retirement age. So the question is, should you reflect real life experience or do we, you know, continue on with the benefit package that we have? Secondly, what is the purpose of a COLA? Is it to reflect cost of living? If so, should it fluctuate with the cost of living? Should it, you know, take a CPIW or you or CPI elderly or whatever and try to have the COLA that we pay on a retiree benefit fluctuate as cost of living changes? That's certainly a possibility, and you'd want to put in some protections like put a cap on it and that sort of thing, and certainly you wouldn't want to go negative on a COLA, but those are changes that states are making and certainly could be something we could look at here. So what level of benefits should be available to members who leave active service mid-career? Should these employees' pension benefits be increased for inflation? And that gets to the question of the augmentation. So if someone leaves public employment, do we feel that it's the kind of benefit that we want to provide to these people who have gone on to other jobs or, you know, quit working for caring for children or whatever it may be, should their benefits increase for inflation? What level of benefits should be available to members who retire early? Should we be subsidizing those benefits? Should we be trying to incentivize people to retire early? Currently, the plans do have incentives to retire early, and I guess is that the kind of behavior that the pension plan should be trying to encourage? Or should, on the flip side, should they incentivize members to continue working to normal retirement age? So I think these are sort of the questions that you can kind of think through, I guess, as you think about the benefit package that we have.
Ms. Barth, any questions?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Barth, Senator Pappas.
Ms. Lincheski, though, don't we, Madam Chair, don't we, we have an early retirement penalty, though. So you said we incentivize people, but it seems like it's the opposite.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, the word penalty is used all the time in this context. And all it means is that if you retire early, well, let's just say you've accrued a benefit that pays you out $500 a month at normal retirement. If you retire at age 55, you're not going to get $500 a month.
Right.
It's going to be ratcheted down. That ratcheting down is referred to as a penalty. So the other way to look at it is if you were to just do that on the basis of an actuarial equivalency, so the $500 a month, say, paid out at starting at age 55 is worth, you know, $300 a month, for instance. What the plans do is not actually that. They will pay you $300, but they'll also bump it up, which is the subsidy part of this. So instead of $300 a month, which would be the actual equivalent, you're going to get $400 a month. So we tend to refer to it as a subsidy because it is extra money that the plan is putting into this benefit. Mm-hmm. That's above and beyond the actual equivalency.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So slide 14, just to kind of move off of, continue to build on slide 13, to provide the Commission with just some questions to consider when assessing proposed benefit changes, especially as we move on in this presentation, questions you could be asking yourself when assessing what we're going to be talking about. So what are core benefits? And a core benefit could be the actual benefit of the accrual rate, high five, and then salary, like benefit, the core benefit, or is it a COLA, or kind of evaluating what people consider as a core benefit. Should benefit changes be driven solely by cost savings, or are there other considerations or motivators? So if a change doesn't save a lot but addresses a policy concern, how should that be evaluated? And for some of the benefit changes we talk about later, there aren't necessarily large cost savings, but there could be policy reasons for making the change. What are the policy considerations? Really determining the pros and cons of a change, stakeholders that are impacted by a change, those types of questions. How important are pensions to attracting and retaining employees? Can a benefit change have an impact on this area? How important is uniformity of pension benefits among Minnesota public employees? And as we've kind of seen, there are some differences among the plans, and kind of ask yourselves, why are there differences, and do these differences need to become similarities? How much does a proposed change impact the value of the benefit? How are other states changing the benefits? Should we actually really care? Is it helpful or useful to us in making a decision? And then sort of specifically to our commission, should the LCPR principles of pension policy be updated to provide more specific guidelines for future benefit adjustments?
We could probably get a subgroup going in the summer to work on our principles. Half joking, but I'm kind of half serious.
So slide 15 is just kind of another way to view the benefit changes and to help determine what is the intent behind a change. Is it a policy change to reflect sort of your philosophical goals of offering a pension benefit? So example, eliminating a subsidized benefit. Is it a sustainability change, which can be made when the existing made within the existing structure of the pension plan to improve funding, so contribution rate increases or lowering the COLA? Or is it a structural change where demographic solutions to demographic problems, like we've seen increased longevity, economic solutions to solve an economic problem? Should our COLA be a little more sensitive to inflation? Those types of questions.
Members, are there any questions on this slide 15? Because I find this somewhat fascinating. I mean, does it serve, if you are going to do some adjustments, it serve to have something in 2 out of 3 or just work on? I mean, I find it fascinating. Anyway, Ms. Lincheski.
Okay, so on to the benefit changes. This all will somewhat depend or will be clarified, I think, by using this chart as well as we go through this. So this is the legal-sized chart of benefit changes. So the way this all kind of came to be is that we were asked to prepare this chart. So the big legal-sized chart goes through all the benefits, and not even all the benefits. It goes through many of the benefits that are provided in each of these three plans. It explains the benefit and then suggests some changes. Senator Rosen and Representative O'Driscoll then selected several of these changes to send out to the plans and have them provide us with some cost estimates as to what the savings might be if we were to adopt these changes or put these into the statutes. As we look at these cost savings, I just want to note that these are definitely estimates. So some of them are based on some old analysis that was done in the last year or two. Some are were done by the actuaries more recently, but they are definitely estimates. Each benefit change needs to be considered in isolation. So the cost savings will change if more than one benefit is approved. Because they kind of oftentimes work in tandem, and what is the cost savings when just one is put in may not be, may not lead to those kinds of cost savings if there's another benefit that's also changed at the same time. Keep in mind that every benefit change can be phased in over time or can take effect at a later date, and that leads to the next point, which is communication of benefit changes. There's always the potential for litigation in this area. So anytime you're making a change to a pension plan, we do it in a way that will reduce the chance of litigation, but communication is key. So we'd have to work with the plans and make sure that they are communicating on a timely and clear basis so that people understand the changes and are given time to absorb them and ask questions and plan around them. And then finally, changes must be made prospectively. So that either would relate to new employees only or new accruals, only future accruals, or to new service, future service. Making sure that there are only prospective changes, again, will reduce the potential or the possibility of any kind of claim being made. So moving on to slide 17. The next four.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Before Ms. Lincheski goes through the changes, I would like to just provide a little bit of background. When you and I sat down and talked about areas, none of these are areas that have had agreement between the commission. They are simply in a research and report mode on this, and they were generated primarily by inquiries from members of the that I had contact with in the legislature, other outside people who have raised questions over time. What about this benefit? What about that benefit? How much savings? What would those kinds of things be? And actually, over since I've been on the Pension Commission, even some of the members who are covered by these plans have asked some of these questions. And so we thought, given the assignment that we have this year, it makes good sense for us to open these up and have some information discussions about the myths and the realities of where some of the savings might actually come from and what they might actually look like in the ways of dollars and cents. And so I just wanted to put that out there as a precursor to the conversation that we're going to have. I don't want anybody walking away saying, my goodness, the Pension Commission is planning on doing all of these things, the sky is falling. This is information, collect, record, and report so that everyone has the same information.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And I hopefully that was said before, and hopefully everybody understands that. It comes from the good work that Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth did earlier, too, to go see what other states are doing and what is happening nationwide. So information only. Let's continue the discussion.
So the first four pages here of the benefit changes, these are slides 17 through 20, relate to changing or eliminating augmentation. So as we discussed, augmentation is different than a COLA. A COLA is what we refer to as the annual increase on the pension that's being paid to retirees. So this is not that. Augmentation is the annual increase that is paid on a pension that has been accrued by somebody who has left public service. So they've accrued a benefit, $500 a month. It's not going to change anymore because they don't have any more service or compensation increases, but it will increase by this, you know, 1% or 2% or whatever it is in the plan each year. Again, they're not working for the state. They're not working in public employment. They're out with a private employer or whatever they're doing, but the state is continuing to increase that benefit. So these four slides, the first two reduce the rate of augmentation to 1%. Benefit change 1A is makes that change to 1% effective for deferral years beginning on and after January 1, 2018 for all current deferred members. So you can see the savings here for instance, MSRS going from 2% to 1% achieves a savings of roughly $2.9 million each year. In the case of TRA, that's about $900,000. And then for St. Paul teachers, it's $260,000 a year. Para is already at zero for augmentation, so we don't reflect para, any cost savings there. The next chart, 1B, reduces the augmentation rate to 1% for all employment terminations on or after January 1, 2018. So this is going to have less of an impact than the other one, which would apply to all future years, all deferral years, whereas this one will only impact people who terminate employment on or after January 1, 2018. The changes or the cost savings here are very similar to what we talked about or what I just mentioned in the prior screen. TRA notes that it is less than what it was shown in the prior chart. And I think the problem with these is that, again, they're estimates, and so it's likely that the others are slightly less as well than the numbers given here. Benefit change 1C reduces the augmentation rate to 0%. As does 1D. Again, it just has a different effective date. So the 1C is effective for all deferral years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. And you can see the savings here. Para does show a savings because currently they're at zero for all deferrals, for all people who terminated employment on or after 2012, it's zero. But prior to that, anybody who termed before then gets a 1%, and that continues on into the future. So there is a pretty good chunk of savings for para when it is applied to all deferral years for all people who are no longer employed. Para also notes that this depends on the COLA trigger being eliminated, which is not in a proposal that they have in front of the commission. Let's see. You can see those numbers. And 1D, very similar again. There isn't much of a change between 1C and 1D with the different effective dates.
Members, Minnesota and South Dakota are the only two states. Am I correct on that, Ms. Sincheski?
Yeah.
Or on this augmentation?
Yeah, South Dakota and Minnesota.
Yeah. Slide 21. Ms. Barth? Is there any questions on the augmentation before we continue?
Okay. All right.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the second benefit change we looked at, which is on page 2 of your big chart, looks at the accrual rate or the multiplier for TRA and St. Paul teachers, which we discussed is 1.9, and the accrual rate for MSRS and para general plans are 1.7. So the benefit change we looked into was to estimate the cost savings for TRA and St. Paul teachers if the multiplier is reduced from 1.9% to 1.7% for all years of service after June 30th, 2017 for all active members. So it's every active member currently in the plans for years of service after June 30th, 2017. And so the cost savings are estimated to be for TRA 0.77% of total payroll, and then an annual savings of $34 million. And then St. Paul teachers' numbers, which actually come from a 2012 study, which, so as we discussed, are purely estimates, is about 0.8% of total payroll, and then an annual savings of $2 million.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know when TRA and the St. Paul teachers formula, the multipliers went up from 1.7 to 1.9?
Ms. Barth? Yes. So for TRA, their multiplier went up from 1.7 to 1.9 in 2006 after the Minneapolis teachers merged into the plan. And then for St. Paul, they went from 1.7 to 1.9 in 2015. So for all years of service after.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
And I worked on that Minneapolis one. And my recollection was it was actually paid for by the teachers. Like they increased their contributions to actually pay for the higher augmentation. And that might have been true of St. Paul as well. So, I mean, I think it's important context to have that when they did it, they actually paid for it.
Absolutely. I agree. Ms. Barth.
That's correct. So TRA, I believe their employee contribution increased by 0.5% in 2006. And then St. Paul, I'm not entirely sure, but I know that they've had a phase in of employee contributions in the past couple of years. So yes, employee contributions were also increased when those went into effect.
Okay. Slide 22. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the same benefit we're looking at. So the accrual rates, only this time it's for just to apply to new hires after June 30th, 2017. And this is a little different because there won't, so for example, for TRA, the immediate cost savings would be minimal because the change only affects new hires. So the savings would occur much later into the future. So when there are eventually savings recognized, that would lower the normal cost of the plan by 0.92% of pay. And then for St. Paul, somewhat of the same phenomenon, but because it's a newer, they've only had the accrual rate at 1.9 for 1 year, it's the same savings for both benefit changes. All right, so slide 23, and this is on page 3 of the big chart. We're looking at the normal retirement age. And so the normal retirement age for MSRS, para general plans, TRA, and St. Paul teachers hired after June 30th, 1989 is 66. The proposed change is to raise the normal retirement age to 67 for new hires after June 30th, 2017. Again, sort of the same phenomena we saw with changing the accrual rate for new hires. The immediate cost savings would be minimal because the change only affects new hires, so the savings would occur much later into the future. Eventually, you can see what the cost savings would be for each plan and how that would reduce the normal cost of the plan. But again, that's pretty far out into the future. We don't have any sort of numbers for how that affects like the funded ratio over the amortization period or anything. So slide 24, again, looking at retirement age, but this time the early retirement age. So there were two changes that we looked at, benefit change 4 and 5. So currently the early retirement age is 55 for MSRS and para general plans and TRA and St. Paul teachers. So change 4 raises the early retirement age to 62 for new hires after June 30th, 2017. The plans let us know that this would achieve no measurable cost savings. The lack of savings, we're kind of guessing, could be impacted by what the 2015 experience studies noted, which is fewer members are actually retiring early. So raising the early retirement age won't necessarily have the expected impact that we may think it would. And then change number 5 is to increase from age 55 to 57 for all early retirements after June 30th, 2017. And again, this would achieve no measurable cost savings, and the cost was neutral. And in the cost savings provided by the plans, they kind of noted that increasing the early retirement age may have some adverse behavioral effects, such as an increase potentially in disability benefit applications. So that's something to also kind of keep in mind, is how these changes affect behavior within the plan.
Ms. Barth, before we move on, just a point of clarification, if we could. Inside MSRS, we have State Patrol, and inside of PERA, we have Police and Fire. When you're talking about these changes, those are for MSRS General and PERA General, and not including PNF, Police and Fire, with PERA and State Troopers. Am I correct on that?
Representative Dursel, yes, you're correct. Just the general plan members.
Senator Chair, Ms. Barth, would you just speak a little closer to the microphone? You did that last time.
I apologize.
You went before. Thank you.
I will move up. There we go. So slide 25 is that better? Okay, good. Is benefit change number 6, and this is on page 4 of the big chart. And this is looking at the COLA. So as we discussed earlier, MSRS and TRA provide a 2% annual COLA to retirees. Para and St. Paul teachers provide a 1% annual COLA increase. So just to kind of look at making all the plans uniform and providing an annual COLA, we asked for cost estimates from just MSRS and TRA, and this is MSRS General, and TRA to lower the COLA from 2% to 1% effective January 1, 2018. And as you can see, this resulted in significant annual savings for both plans. This was the largest savings we saw of all the benefit changes we looked at. So that $108 million for MSRS and that $192 million for TRA are an annual savings. So just to give you an idea of how sensitive the savings can be when you lower the COLA. And then slide 26. We looked at, so currently members who retire early receive a full annual COLA beginning 18 months after retirement. So people who retire early after they have been retired for 18 months will receive either the 2% or the 1% COLA depending on the plan that they're a member of. So the change we looked at is to postpone that COLA increase for early retirees until the retiree reaches normal retirement age, which a majority are at 66. So that's their normal retirement age. And you can see for all four plans, there were noticeable cost savings on an annual basis if you do not provide a COLA to a member until they reach normal retirement age.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pappas.
And is that at the 2% COLA, or are these at the 1% COLA?
Ms. Barth.
So these are the COLAs they currently provide.
Currently provide.
Yeah, so MSRS and TRA would be at 2, and then PERA and St. Paul would be at 1.
Ms. Lajewski.
Okay, just finishing up here, we looked at two additional changes, and these both relate to that early retirement subsidy that I was talking about earlier. So this is where the normal retirement benefit is reduced, and one way to do that is just do it with an actuarial equivalency. So you go from age 65 benefit down to, say, age 55, and there's a reduction in that to reflect the additional years of paying out the benefit. The plans all bake in an augmentation rate, which was not touched when the augmentation rate went from 2.5% and 3% down to 2% or 1%. So they still have the higher rates, and their actuaries, our actuary Deloitte and their actuary GRS, have said on more than one occasion that this looks like an oversight and should be fixed. So it's not really... the proposal then, or the option here, is to change the augmentation, and in this case, to eliminate it altogether. The next change is to bring the augmentation down to the current augmentation rate. So 8A eliminates the augmentation as it is used in determining the early retirement subsidy. And you can see here that eliminating the augmentation from the early retirement calculation does achieve some savings here. Obviously, they're pretty significant savings, $17 million, $35 million for Paris, $57 million for TRA, and $1.8 million for St. Paul. So, again, this is only in the early retirement calculation, so in determining that benefit. Then 8B reduces the augmentation to match the current augmentation rates of 1% or 2%, depending on the plan. And that, too, does, you can see the savings here, $5 million for MSRS, $5.7 million, $35.4 for PARA, which looks very much like the other one. Not sure what's going on there. But then TRA you can see that it's less than the prior screen, the prior slide. And then for St. Paul teachers, it's $520,000. So just finally to wrap up the discussion here, or the explanation of these benefit changes, TRA did provide us with information about what TRA would look like at the end of the 30-year amortization period for each proposed change. They provided that independently. The other plans did not. So we didn't include that information in here, but we certainly could go back to the other plans and get that kind of data, and that would give us a sense of where we would be in 30 years' time if we were to make these benefit or each of these benefit changes. And then I mentioned this earlier, that if more than one change is proposed, we might want to reassess the cost savings so that we can see what, in fact, would be the cost savings that would be achieved if you know, several benefit changes were adopted all at the same time.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth. Members, are there any questions? Representative Anderson.
From a historical perspective, have we ever, like, just frozen the COLAs for 5 years to say we're just going to do that?
Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah. Representative Anderson, Senator Rosen, TRA did freeze their COLA, and I don't remember exactly the years, but it was 2 or 3 years where they actually did freeze it.
And what I mean by freezing...
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I mean by freezing is actually just bring it to 0% for, you know, a period of time.
So I suppose we could ask... Senator Rosen, Representative Anderson. TRA is probably in the audience and could speak to that, but TRA is the plan that did bring it down to zero, and I don't know how many years that, you know, that situation was the case, but we can certainly get that... If you'd like, I think
it's two. I think it's 2 years.
Okay. Yeah, Rachel has a different chart here that was prepared earlier, and it looks like the COLA was suspended or not paid for the years 2011 and 2012.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Can you just go over the early retirement and augmentation piece again? Explain the early retirement, I guess, to begin with, and then...
Slide 27, 28. Ms. Lucheski.
Yeah, so that... thank you, Senator Rosen. Representative Thiessen. So when the actuary does the reduction, or when they determine the factors that the plans use to do...
Yes, Representative Lee Thiessen.
Yeah.
Sure. Ms. Lincheski.
Okay, so that was the explanation I had provided earlier to Senator Pappas about the penalty. So what happens with the early retirement benefit is, first off, you determine what the normal retirement benefit is going to be at age 65. And that's based on the factor times years of service times comp. Then there are factors that are applied to that to bring that benefit down to what is actuarially equivalent to that normal retirement benefit, taking into account the 10 extra years that the benefit will be paid out. So if it's going down on age 55 benefit, then you've got to factor in that additional 10 years of payments. In the case of the plans, they don't use a straight actuarial equivalency. They don't just bring it down for that. They also add in an augmentation rate to reflect the fact that the person who takes early retirement won't get augmentation for those years. But what happened here is that when they dropped the augmentation rates generally down to 2 or 1%, they didn't also drop the rate in the calculation of the early retirement benefit. So it still had 2.5% or 3% as the augmentation rate that was taken into account in determining the early retirement benefit. So they sort of give you an extra benefit, a little extra bump up to reflect the fact that for those 10 years, you're going to get a pension payment instead of augmentation on the pension. And augmentation actually isn't paid until you start to draw down the benefit, but you sort of accrue it each year. Is that...
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they're reducing the piece I don't get is they're actually reducing the amount, taking that into account. I'm missing something here. So I mean, what it sounds like you're saying is you're going to retire. If you retire at 65, you'd get $10,000. But because you're retiring at 55 and not paying in for a period of time, we're going to reduce that by a certain formula, which includes the anticipated augmentation. So I guess I don't. It seems like the anticipated augmentation being higher would actually drive the starting point lower.
Well, So the straight actuarial equivalency just reflects those additional years of payment. But what the plans do in determining the payments that the additional years of payments is they provide some additional in that monthly amount that's paid starting at age 55 to reflect the loss of the augmentation that the person would have gotten had they not started to take their pension at age 55.
I got it. All right. Thank you.
It's complicated.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am the new guy on this committee, and I'm not proposing anything. I'm just asking some questions, so there's no dumb questions. So a couple things. So when I was in local government, we always tried and standardize things and try and get everybody kind of on the same playing field. So, and I know that has to be done over time, but has there been a goal to get some of these? You know, you got 1 at 2, 1 at 1, 1 at 1.5. It seems that we're kind of all over the board, and I think the ultimate goal, and I know it sometimes takes time, is to try and get everything more standardized so we don't have to go through all these issues every year of one's here, one's there, one's that. And then just another point on the augmentation, and again, this is just a comment or a question, I guess. The augmentation, it's almost as if we're benefiting someone to leave because we're giving a 2% augmentation versus staying. So if we want to give someone a benefit, it's more of staying there to give these benefits versus if they leave, they get a higher percent because COLA is at 1%. Augmentation is at 2%. It seems like we're almost benefiting the people that leave or don't stay in service. So, again, and I know there's some age differences between police and fire versus teachers and state employees, so I know some of those things have to be different, but is our ultimate goal is to try and get these standardized? And, again, back to the augmentation thing, is are we really benefiting people who are leaving us and not staying with us? So those are just my comments. I don't mean if anybody, it's just questions, and I'm just trying to get up to speed on all these things, but maybe people or some commissioners have or committee members have questions for or answers for my questions. Thank you.
Well, Senator Jasinski, when we did this, the major reform in 2010, I think there was a movement by all the plans, and they moved together succinctly. And I think there was agreement for all their different changes.
Sorry.
I think this research that Ms. Barth and Ms. Lecheski has done over the interim has been very eye-opening. We've never had this before. As far as I can go back, Senator Pappas, do you remember that? Representative Murphy, do you remember anything like this? So this is eye-opening what other states are doing and the possibilities. I didn't even know about augmentation. Did you know about this, Representative Murphy? You did.
Augmentation?
Yep. Oh, wow. Thank goodness you have that historical point. So I'm learning a lot about this, but the point is to make sure that all the plans are comfortable with the other plans' movement and that we can afford it, because right now we're at about $400 million from the contribution increases from the plans, and that's not including the direct aid for St. Paul teachers or is it the para? Police and fire? Yeah, the $9 million per year. So over $400 million is what they're asking for. That's a lot. That's a lot. So, yes, Senator Schoen, and then Representative O'Driscoll.
And Madam Chair and Senator, I mean, I know that there's a lot of consideration into
external pieces. It's kind of like, you know, each committee has a goal that if you spend a dollar over here, it may save three over in this other committee. It's a different silo. And there's a lot of consideration just what an early retirement can do for the employer, too. Whereas those dollar and salary savings, they benefit the employer and the employee if someone can get out before they're hurt, you know, on the verge of becoming hurt. And if you're a police officer, firefighter, or correctional employee in some of these places where you get a pretty labor-intensive job, and if you can get out, the goal is, the reason that age is what it is because you shouldn't be doing it that long and your body can't handle it. And also the employer, you know, they will hire folks that are at a lower wage, and that's a cost savings in the beginning for a while as well, too. So, I mean, there's a lot more considerations than just what's on one particular spreadsheet that have to be factored into the decisions that we make, too, and that we negotiate with employees. So something to think
Absolutely.
About. Thank you.
Absolutely. Representative O'Driscoll, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of go back to the two things, one to the dollar amount that you spoke about, and then one back to augmentation. The way I've always kind of viewed augmentation, and again, please someone correct me if I'm off base on this, if you stopped working at 55 but waited to collect your benefits until age 62, you're basically accruing for that seven-year period of time, a 2% augmentation, even though it may be on a reduced benefit because you left before the normal retirement age. Is that an accurate way to kind of summarize what we were looking at on that?
Ms. Lajewski.
I think, though, that if you leave at 55 and start drawing down your early retirement benefit, you're talking about the case where you quit at 55 but don't take it until 62. That's correct. You would get that augmentation then for those years.
Madam Chair, that's where augmentation comes in. You cease employment, so therefore you don't have the average of your last 5 years. It stops at age 55, and you may work at 65 for that 10 years doing something else in some other capacity outside of public employment, but you continue to get an augmentation on that at the rate of 2%. And it's not that you retire at 55, get a 1% plus another 2% in COLAs. It's really the fact that you're not drawing the benefit where that comes in until at some point in the future. So someone who actually retires at age 65 would still be able to receive, at 55, but waiting to draw until normal retirement age would not see a reduction, but would also see an augmentation at that point as well. It's where you start drawing benefits before that you receive the reduced monthly benefit. And if you wait to, and the reverse of that is if you wait to draw the benefit, you have less of a penalty, but you also have an augmentation that helps get you caught up to what you might have been at a normal retirement age.
Ms. Lajewski.
Just one other comment, Representative O'Driscoll, on that topic. You actually, though, can start receiving augmentation on your pension at age 25. I mean, as long as you have a vested benefit in the plan, you are going to get 2% per year.
Madam Chair,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Point well made that it's not age-specific, it's service-specific that we'd see that. Madam Chair, to the $400 million that you referenced, that is not a one-time payment. That is once we get to cruising altitude with an implementation of some plan as it was presented to us by the plans. This is not something that's been adopted or moving forward, but as presented by the plans. The employees have a contribution that's not in that $400 million. This is public dollars that will be coming from schools and cities and state agencies and other employing entities that we'd be looking at. And so once we get to cruising altitude, it'll be that additional $400 million that will continue to be paid until, dare I say, perpetuity, because that's the goal of the plans is to continue on at that point. So it's not, boy, we got $400 million in, we're saved. It's ramping up to that number and maintaining that number on top of all of the other contributions, fixes, and things that have been done in the past. So I just want to put some context into this.
Thank you.
As well.
Senator O'Driscoll. Yes, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments. As long as we're talking about augmentation, I do think it's kind of odd that it doesn't match the COLA. And so I'm interested to see if there's some reasoning behind that. Why, you know, the COLAs have been at zero, the COLAs have been at 1%, they've been at 2.5%, but augmentation has been more stable than that. So I think that's something to look at. I do think in terms of the multiplier that I do remember I was here, I don't know if I was quite on the Pension Commission yet, I might have been on the Pension Commission when we did increase the multiplier for teachers, but they came in and said they'd pay more for that. So I think that's something to be careful of, is that was important to them in terms of recruitment or what other rationale behind that. It'd be good to go back and kind of look at that. I'm just pointing that out. And then I think we have to be really cautious as we make any changes that might impact people who are very close to retirement, because they've already got their, you know, their plans. They're counting on so much money that they're going to get in retirement. They may be, you know, eliminating assets or gathering assets in preparation for that. And that, I think, that could also maybe get us in some legal problems if we are impacting people when we've already going back on promises we've already made.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. I hope this discussion has been fruitful and good. I think this is very good information. Representative Murphy.
Great, yep. Okay, thank you. I would like, and I don't think that you have it tonight, but I'd like to have an idea of how many augmentation retirees we have, or how many are in the various plans.
Ms. Lincheski?
We actually have that number here. So if you look over on, well, this one anyway. So on screen or slide 9, mm-hmm. Do you have the number for para? If you look at the line for deferred vested members, so every deferred vested member, if they're vested, which is why they're in that category, gets augmentation. So, for instance, MSRS General has, you know, 17,000. In the case of PARA, they stopped augmentation for a certain group. So for everybody who retired prior to 2012, continued to get augmentation. Everybody who terminated after that date did not. So they're at zero. So that group is actually a little, the group that gets augmentation is a little less, and I think it was around 32,000, and I could get the exact number for you, but it's less than 52,000. Mm-hmm. But then you can see for para, there's 13,680, and for teachers, 2,020. So all of those members are receiving augmentation.
Representative
Driscoll.
Thank you. That helps.
Madam Chair, to Representative Murphy's question, which then gave me pause to think about those individuals who are deferred, they've left their funding in the plan where their employer match was in there. There could have been a situation where an individual left covered service, withdrew their portion because the employer portion needs to stay in the plan, and that's not portable, and that doesn't go with the employee. So having said that, the question becomes, how does the issue work when an individual comes back to covered employment, reaches the years of service to pay back? Do they have to pay anything for that augmentation or the potential for that augmentation benefit?
Ms. Lincheski.
So if they leave the plan and don't take their benefit, they leave employment, don't take their benefit, leave it in the plan and continue to get... You're talking about the case where they take a refund and they then do not get augmentation and then they come back to service.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative O'Driscoll.
So I'll just put it into context. Somebody's 25 years old. They're a teacher. They leave after 4 years. They say, you know what, I'm going to take that money out. Then at age 35, they go back into covered teaching service for another 10 years. They say, gee, you know, 4 plus 10, that's 14 years. I want to pay back the refund on this. We know we have to pay the anticipated rate of return because that's always been the policy. Do we have anything that we have to address with augmentation on something like that or the potential for augmentation? And we may not have the answer. It's a question that may bear some research in coming back to the committee. And like I said, it just dawned on me when we were talking about the two different possibilities tonight.
I'm sure we will be ruminating on this for a while. So there's no further questions. We'll see you on the 7th, and we'll start working on our bill. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Yes.